Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFPU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we revisit a part of Brock history from 1972, when a Brock research team spent part of that spring at Pond Inlet on Baffin Island, and three undergraduate students had their spring convocation ceremony while still up there. We talk hockey, always a great Canadian subject, and a Canadian invention that was developed thanks to research done by Kelly Lockwood up at Brock. And we congratulate an associate professor in the Department of Classics, Fanny Delansky, on her award-winning paper entitled Playing with Gender, Girls, Dolls, and Adult Ideals in the Roman World. Radio that ices the puck both here and in the Arctic, Inquisitive Minds, is on the air. For many students at Brock today, you say Pond Inlet, and they automatically think of that little area tucked away in the Mackenzie Chown complex, in close proximity to the pond and waterfall located just beyond the glass doors. I was there last evening, in fact. I thought it was named for what lay behind those glass doors myself. But dig a little deeper and talk to people associated with Brock about 40 years ago, and they know the real story behind Pond Inlet. That is a community on Baffin Island where a Brock research team spent time in the spring of 1972 studying the sea ice in Eclipse Sound as an aid in designing vessels that could travel in the region. While at Pond Inlet in the Arctic, three Brock geology undergraduates and field assistants on the expedition, Wayne Gesso, Kenneth Blewett, and Brian Schreiner, had their spring convocation at a ceremony held May 30, 1972, with a platform constructed using a dog sled placed on gasoline drums. As we celebrate Brock's 50th anniversary this year, I thought it might be fun to spend a bit of time reminiscing about the event that made international headlines back at the time. We've been in contact with two of the three participants in the Arctic Convocation of 1972, and one of them joins us on the phone today from his home in Carcross in the Yukon near Whitehorse. Ken Blewett joined us recently on the phone, and I asked him first if he thought in his wildest imagination it would become such a big international story back in 1972.
Prior to it, the three of us didn't know that that was going to happen. We thought we were just up there on a project, and we would do our work, and when the project was done, we'd come back home, and that would be the end of it.
Well, take me back to when you first heard you were going to the Arctic. Was there a sense of adventure, or maybe even a feeling of dread that you were going up so far north?
No, I never had a feeling of dread. I actually really relished the idea. To me, it was exploration. It was seeing something and feeling something and being someplace where you had read about and books and maybe saw a little bit on movies and whatnot, but had never been there. And I was anxious to see that. I wanted to see what the North was like. I think I always had kind of an interest in the North. I just was very happy, very thrilled and excited to have that opportunity to go North.
Now, you were studying the sea ice in Eclipse Sound to better assist shipping interests heading through the area. In fact, a German shipping interest helped to fund part of the expedition. Do you remember at all what you found when you got up there?
When we landed, we went from Montreal to Hull Beach right up to Pond Inlet by airplane. I think it took a couple of trips. And there was roughly 25 of us, Canadians and Germans, people all there. We found this small village. Just the scenery was absolutely breathtaking, spectacular. And what I was really enthralled about is when the plane landed, the whole town came out to see us, to greet us, because planes didn't go in there every day. And the townsfolks were curious too. And I remember looking on shore and looking across that Violet Island, which is about, if I remember, roughly 25 kilometers, and that was a stretch of sea ice that we would be studying, that we would be working on. And from a little bit of a distance, it looked pretty nice. But when you actually got out on the sea ice, it was pretty rough, rafted and ridged and all this type of stuff. And there was a movement in the sea ice. I think it moved around 3 feet up and down with the tide. We didn't even realize until we were there for some time because you just couldn't tell it. And we had to be very careful. They told us, I remember when we went up, Dr. Trasmi told us, you have all kinds of people with doctors and PhDs with all kinds of technical knowledge, but he said, when the Inuit tell you something about that ice, he said, you listen to it because they know that ice. We had to be careful with what they called leads, cracks in the ice. Sometimes it'd be just a few inches wide, and the next day they might be feet wide and snowed over a little bit. You know, the chances of going down through that 3,000 feet deep. So you had to be careful, but it was wonderful.
So how long were you actually there doing the work on the study?
I'm trying to remember that. I don't know if it was a couple months, something like that. 3 months at the most, I think.
Now, you couldn't have arrived too early in the year, given the fact that you're way up in the Arctic. When did you arrive?
And that I've been trying to remember, too. I don't know whether it's late April.
Okay.
Or in there, I think.
Okay, so do you remember who first floated the idea of having your spring convocation in the Arctic?
That had to be Dr. Trasme, Jan Trasme, I would think, and Ed Mernick, Dr. Mernick, the professors in the geology department. I think it was them that thought that that would be not only very interesting for the three of us, but also very good for the university itself to be able to do this. I don't know a lot of the behind the scenes from that, but those are the people that I would think that did that.
So tell me about the ceremony. I gather it must have been a pretty small affair.
We didn't know the ceremony was going to take place, but when it did, the day of the ceremony, we went down to the ice front on an Odwell tractor, snow machine, and there was a Kinatic, which is a sled set up on two 45-gallon fuel drums, and we had Michael Moore was pro-chancellor, and there's two RCMP officers, one at either end, and Dr. Trasme, and other dignitaries there, and the whole town came down to the waterfront. I don't think they really knew what was going on, but they all came down there curious. They wanted to know, and I thought that was a real treat, and after the ceremony was over, they came by and everybody shook hands with us.
When Brock named the area in the Mackenzie Chown Complex Pond Inlet, that must have pleased you when they named it after this special area that you had spent time in.
Yes, indeed. I thought that was very nice. It was quite an honor to be part of that process. Yes, I was very pleased about that.
So tell me about the rest of the time you spent at Brock. You were a geology student, and when were you there?
I started in 68 and finished in 72. I came from a small town, went to small schools. I went to Brock because it was a small school at that time for an education to develop a career, but to have this event added into that, it was beyond what we would have ever thought about.
Have you been back to Brock since you graduated?
I have a couple times, but not for quite a few years.
Well, it's certainly changed quite a bit in the years since you left.
I can imagine.
Now, you're up in Whitehorse now. What do you do up there? What's your work?
We're actually about south, about an hour south and a little bit west of Whitehorse. And my wife is a teacher, and I have some family here. My oldest daughter is a nurse, and her husband has an outfitting business, and they came to the Yukon about 10 years ago because they said it was the way of life that they wanted to follow. And she convinced us about 7 years ago, she said, it's time to get out of the big cities and whatnot down south and come north for a better quality of life. And we thought, well, this is the opportunity to do it. So my wife is a teacher, as I was saying, so she was able to get a job up here. And I haven't been in the mining industry for a number of years. And the principal of the school that we first came to asked if I would be interested in working at the school as an EA, educational assistant. And I thought on that and thought it'd be a good idea, and I've done that ever since.
So you were in the mining industry once you graduated from Brock then?
Yes, mining exploration, yes.
So how long were you at that?
I was in that about, I think, 16 years, and that took me from back into the Arctic a number of times, north of the Arctic Circle again, all the way through Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, and to Newfoundland. That's where my oldest daughter was actually born, was down in Newfoundland, so we're quite pleased about that.
So you must be pretty much a northern boy by now.
I think I always had a fascination for the north, and my wife is from northern Ontario, a small mining town up there, and I was from a farm east of Toronto, about an hour, so we're used to small places, and this lifestyle suits us very much. We just enjoy it. It's not crowded. I'm sitting in my house right now, looking out all four directions into mountains and snow-covered. We're northerners.
Well, I wanted to talk about life up there in the Yukon. I'd like to get a bit of a snapshot here, because down in southern Ontario here, for example, this winter, people are finding almost unbearable. Now, it's probably laughable for you up where you are, but we've had more snow than we're used to, and it's been a lot colder. Again, not as cold as you're used to, but for us, it's a lot colder, especially here in what's generally considered the more temperate Niagara region. So tell me what it's like up there. What's a typical winter like up in the Yukon?
It partly depends where you are. If you're closer to the coast a little bit, it can be a little bit milder. When we first came to the Yukon, we were in Watson Lake, which is about 400 kilometers east of us, and it was slightly cooler there a little bit. We would get maybe, I remember when we first came, we had 2 or 3 weeks of minus 40 and a week of minus 50 plus. And 1 year we were down there, we had had, I think it was total snowfall throughout the year was around 11 or 12 feet. And if you had to come to Whitehorse, it was about 450 kilometers. You were careful about doing that. You made sure you had proper safety equipment and supplies in your vehicle because it was a long way in between. There's not a lot of traffic on the roads and there's not a lot of stopping places. There's a couple that you can stop if you need to get help. But you're just careful in what you do. But the old-timers tell me the temperatures used to get colder than that, like in the 60s, and I've heard them say into the 70s years ago.
Yeah, I guess that's the same everywhere. Oh, it's not as cold now as it used to be years ago when I was growing up.
Actually, they called for plus one, I think, here today right now.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. That's about the same as here in Niagara, actually.
We've actually had some warmer days up here than you have down there during this past winter for a few weeks. I have a daughter, and my mother still lives down there, my daughter and her husband, and their temperature's been colder down there than we have had up here.
Yeah, don't rub it in. But I would think that if you're going on some kind of a trip in this weather, the very cold, wintry weather that is commonplace up there, you have to plan for that. So what concessions do you have to make in that regard? Because, I mean, you can't just get in the car, say, well, we're going to go for an hour drive and visit so-and-so in some other town. I would think that you have to be much more careful how you plan that out because, as you mentioned earlier, there aren't a lot of stops for you along the way. So what happens if you find yourself at the side of the highway somewhere and your car breaks down?
One thing we did when we came here is, after we were here for a couple of years, we did buy a four-wheel drive vehicle because they're a little bit safer if you do get into a little bit of snow or a little bit of trouble, you might get yourself out. But you make sure that you have really good heavy parkas and snow pants and things like this, sweaters, layers of clothes, take blankets. It's always a good idea to carry an axe in the car in the wintertime and matches in case you have to make a fire. Take a little bit of food. And if you are stopped, then you just have to be prepared to flag somebody down when they go by. And people up here are pretty good that way. They will stop and help you out if there is a problem.
Because they know just how serious it is for you. If you experience a problem, they can't just leave and say, well, somebody else will deal with this.
No, absolutely not. Because at minus 40 or 45 or whatever it might get down to, your car, everything cools off very quickly. And if you have no way to keep yourself warm or out of the elements, it can get kind of tense. So yes, people are very good that way. They will stop and look after you.
So it's basically a genteel retirement up north now.
In a sense, yes.
Ken, thank you very much for your time. I'm fascinated by life up north. My parents, they made no less than 5 trips to Alaska and the Yukon. They loved it up there. I never made the trip myself, but seeing the pictures that they would bring back and the stories they would bring back, I'd very much like to get up there at some point myself. It sounds like an entirely different way of life from what we have down here. And it's interesting that it all started for you about 40 years ago when you were at Brock University.
That's great. That was the foundation. That was the beginning of it. And I appreciate Brock for giving me that. I really do.
Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Brock alumni member Ken Blewett from the graduating class of 1972, one of 3 students who attended their spring convocation while doing research in the Arctic at the Real Pond Inlet that spring. Next week, we hope to meet another member of that trio of convocation students, Brian Schreiner, who now lives in Saskatchewan. So have you had enough of hockey season yet? Of course you haven't. We are a hockey-mad nation, by and large. And although I don't always share the enthusiasm displayed by my Canadian compatriots, I do admire the science behind the game and the work that goes into developing the athletes who play the game. That brings us to our next guest, or rather, guests. Kelly Lockwood is an associate professor of kinesiology in the Department of Health Sciences at Brock, and Troy Crowder is the founder, inventor, and CEO of a company called True Stride. Born out of the research they collaborated on, a new skate component was developed that can be installed on any skate boot to increase the boot's ability to flex. Both Kelly and Troy joined us recently, Kelly in the studio, Troy by phone, to talk hockey, the recent conclusion of the Olympics, and the science behind the sport of hockey. And I asked Kelly, first of all, about her work evaluating Olympic athletes all these years and what becomes of all that work that she does.
Well, you always look at the gold standard or the people that are on the podium to learn from. And so our work in the past is you analyze performance, you analyze equipment, you analyze evaluation or judging, and you come up with ideas. All right, the Olympics are next to be scheduled in the next 4 years, and what can we do differently? What can we do better? It's not a stationary environment.
So you're always looking for improvement.
Always.
Now, this may be the novice in me inquiring about this, but can the human factor in hockey be improved that much now given what we know? Are we basically operating at the optimum level now is what I'm asking. And now it's more a fact of refining that optimum level with the equipment and the techniques that are being used now.
I think you're asking the million-dollar question. My background in exercise physiology and biomechanics always says, what can we do to make the body better? I think we'd be remiss to say that the human body does, or potentially has, a ceiling effect. But then we come up with other ideas in terms of how can we train them better? How can we refine technique? Or more importantly, how can we harness the physicality and the biomechanics, the technique that they have, through equipment that might be really evolutionary?
What's the biggest fault most hockey players have when they come to the abilities on the ice? If there's one common thing that seems to run through most of the players that you deal with?
They all come with several attributes, but it's their ability to put it all together that really takes them to the top. That said, the foundation of the sport is skating. And unfortunately, I still feel that the fundamentals of skating, being able to skate well and use your equipment to facilitate that movement, is a downfall. And I know we're working really hard at the grassroots level to ensure that skating technique is taught well through all levels of play so that they've got an appropriate foundation. It's no different, really, than some of the other sports. If we look at soccer, we teach the kids how to kick and how to score. But who taught them how to run? Often in the sport of hockey, we teach them how to shoot, we teach them how to score. That is the ultimate performance factor. But who taught them how to skate? And they have to get to that puck first.
I have never learned, I will admit this publicly, I've never learned to skate properly after all these years.
You're never too old to learn.
Now, I was going to ask both of you about this because about 20 years ago, my then girlfriend, who was an avid skater, decided, Mike, I'm going to get you on skates if it kills me. It almost killed me. So we went to a skate exchange, and I got what I considered a really archaic pair of skates. They barely fit. I still, to this day, cannot skate properly. Maybe I just didn't get trained properly. We're not together now, so I can afford to say that now. But I thought at the time, this boot, the blade, everything, it's so archaic. Has there been any significant development in the design of the boot and the blade, the whole package, in living memory?
There's certainly a lot of history, a lot of culture associated with boots, blades, and blade holders. And I know Troy will speak to this as well, but there has been an evolution in boot design. The bigger question is, are we evolving in the right direction? And I think I can speak for both figure skating and hockey that there has been progression in boot design, that we need stiff, we need light, we need stability. However, when you look at the movements required of the athlete, they need to be flexible, they need to bend, they need to stop and start on a dime, they need quick accelerations. That boot needs to be an extension of the body, and at no point are any of our joints fixed. We need to be able to flex. So although the short answer to your question is, yes, I believe there's been some evolution in the boot design, the more appropriate answer might be, is there evolution of boot design? Has it been in the right direction? Are we doing what we should be doing to facilitate performance?
Yeah, no, I go back to a very simple theory is if you walk down a nice, smooth, paved road, you never really look down at your feet. You just look ahead to where you're going. And if you walk through the forest or through a pothole-ridden road, you would constantly be looking down to find your balance. And it's no different when you're in a sport, especially hockey or figure skating, where you're riding on such a thin balance point. You need to have that centered under your balance. You need to be able to flex and bend in the appropriate areas that make you feel comfortable, like you're in a natural position. And if those aren't there, you end up compensating for it, and your body weight gets aligned in different areas. You start to compensate by using other muscles more than other muscles. And more so, you put your head down because you're constantly trying to figure out where you're located, where the puck's located, versus being very comfortable in that natural, like it is a part of your body. Like there's no difference between the skate blade and your natural body versus feeling like you're wearing something that doesn't belong there. That's basically where I've taken my inventing, is to try to transform boots into things that you can customize to your particular body shape, size, so that you can feel comfortable over those skates. And that come in two major areas. There's there's a lot of minor areas as well, but two major areas would be in the flexion that we're going to talk about, being able to bend to your particular bending point based on the thickness of your bone structure, your shins and your heels, and then also blade alignment, which has to do with where that blade runs underneath your boot. If I'm knock-kneed and fallen arches or flat feet, or if I'm bow-legged or whatever, your hip center may be off from the norm, that middle of my foot isn't the middle of my foot the same for everybody. I know my kids, I move my blades on their skates sometimes up to a half an inch one way or another to find their center balance point. And some of that's been going on with figure skating, but it isn't mass done. It's more in the high end. It's never been done in hockey. And so these are things that I'm trying to transform into an everyday commonplace ability so that you can buy a pair of skates and you can change where your blades are, where your bending point is, and a few other components, and that way you can feel like you're actually over your skates and you feel like they're a part of your body instead of kind of an extra external piece of equipment.
So I'm assuming in this, from what you're telling me, the boot has to be rigid to a point because it's supporting the weight of the body on the blades, but there's not enough flexibility there for some people built into it. So what you've been trying to do is to increase the flexibility without losing the inherent properties of the rigidity, the benefits of that rigidity.
Yeah, and the rigidity comes in the concept of you could have a Ferrari engine, but if you're driving in a Volkswagen Beetle with that Ferrari engine, you can't take a corner very fast because the suspension will just collapse on you and you won't be able to handle the corner. So the rigidity is important in the side-to-side stability for you don't want to lose the strength and the pressure and the response time. You want that stiffness there so when you push off against your skate, it's instantaneous. But you also have to have forward flexion to be able to get low enough to take off quick, to turn quick, to have your weight over top of your skates for balance and all the other little things that come with it to be able to keep your head up so that you can see where you're going. All these things kind of come into it. So it's a combination of side stability but still having the proper flexion. And we are doing this initial testing with Kelly. My assistant coach and I in Barrie had the same length of feet, size 12, but if you measured from the back of my heel to the front of my shin, I was 6 inches. If you measure from the back of his heel to the front of his shin, he was 4 inches. That's 2 inches difference, and so that affects how we flex forward because the laces dig in 2 inches earlier on me than they would on him, and that just makes no sense whatsoever that we would wear the same boot. But there is no option in boot design giving you that multiple eyelet or adjustable eyelet or custom fit eyelet position, and that's basically what I'm trying to create.
Okay, so in other words, even though the boot can come in different sizes, even with each size, that one size does not fit all.
No.
Now, the project that you both worked on, Kelly and Troy, the 55 Flex, this is an aftermarket item that would work on any boot then.
Yeah, it'll fit on any size, any boot, any model, and that way you're not going out and reinvesting $600 or $700 or $800 on a pair of custom skates. For under $50, you're buying this product, putting on your skates, and you're giving yourself the benefit of having a custom fit flex point. And hockey's an expensive sport. Ice time, power skating, you know, I mean, a stick is $200-$300 now. So for less than $50, you can transform not only your skating, but once your skating improves, your shooting, your passing, all parts of your game are improved with the added on to your existing boot.
So how did this collaboration between the two of you come about? Because you're on the one end, hey, I need something that works better than what I've got right now. Kelly's on the other end saying, maybe I can solve this problem for you. So how did this collaboration start, and how long did it take for you to come up with the end result?
Well, we both met with a skate company, both kind of pitching our abilities. I was pitching my new product, and Kelly was pitching her ability to prove and test and validate how things really work. And I had had success just doing it on my own, but never really documenting anything or whatever. And basically, too, I was trying to take it to a level where it was commercially viable versus my homemade garage version that I was doing at the time. And so I had the idea, and Kelly had the facility and the knowledge to be able to take that and quantify it. And in the world of academics, she's one of the few that thinks like a business person. You come across a lot of academics that are very much into the protocol of what the academic world does, but Kelly has a unique balance of being both an academic and understanding how the business world works. And from a guy who is an ex-hockey player with a little bit of business knowledge and not a lot, and very little academic know-it-all, she was able to take my product and take me to a level where I was actually ready to then take it into stores. And it's a process, and the academic world and the governmental world of granting and research have been very much a formula you have to follow, and so that slowed things down a little bit. But timing is everything, and I think right now I'm at the point where I have a great product because of all the stuff that I've done with Kelly, and the boot world is ready for it now. So I think everything happens for a reason, and I'm quite happy that Kelly and I crossed paths a couple of years back.
So Kelly, what were you able to do when Troy came to you? What were you able to do to solve the problem? Sort of like the basics of what you would have had to go through.
I think I'll start by saying is the hockey industry is a really close network, and it's amazing how many opportunities there are for collaboration. It's not that you go looking for them, but your passion drives you. And as I've said, my work in athlete development has always been, how can I train this athlete, or how can I work with them on developing technique that's going to help them be a better performer? I would be remiss to say I'm not going to enter the world of equipment design, because they've got to be able to harness that power that they've developed through their physicality, through the equipment, and when the rubber hits the road, it's got to make a difference. And so I think the work that we were originally doing in the lab on skating mechanics, taking it to that next level, you take it into the real world or into the arena. Troy brought the arena to us. He brought some real problems that exist within the industry, and from as being a player himself, giving back to the sport and saying, this was something I struggled with in my career, and it's now my opportunity to make it better for the athletes coming through the system tomorrow. So what we were able to do is mechanically look at what are the demands of skating, what is that optimal level of flex or degree of forward flexion that will enable the athlete to have a very efficient skating stride, not only be able to achieve those speeds, but be able to accelerate quickly, to be able to push, as Troy was saying, you know, when I push against the ice, I want all of that force to push back at me and cause acceleration. And one of the things that we realized very early in the game was, although a boot does have the stability and the support and this thing called protection, because it is a very dynamic game and very physical, it does that well. It doesn't allow the athlete to move in the way it needs to move to support an efficient skating stride. So we could go down the route and talk to all the different boot manufacturers and say, you need to change for this reason. And they're going to say, that's a huge operation to change our designs. Or we can come up with, and in many ways, I've called it a Band-Aid solution. And that's where research starts. You figure out, all right, what's the prototype? What's the theory behind this? Can I come up with something that allows us to investigate whether or not this type of device would work? The original research, the data that came out of it was extremely motivating. You put on a pair of skates, you tie them up to the top, and can you bend at the ankles and knees? The answer is no. Athletes are smart, and they're also intuitive to what they need to do, and sometimes they make systems work. So what athletes typically do is they don't tie up their skates to the top. They leave those top two eyelets undone so they can bend at their ankles and bend at their knees. If they had just screamed a little bit louder and went back to the boot manufacturer and said, these are not working for me, the boot manufacturer may be more motivated to make a change. But they're not. So the lace extender or a 55 flex, this device will attach to any boot, regardless of the brand loyalty or the boot you choose you like to wear. So we're respecting that. But put this on and it attaches at the top two eyelets, and it allows a good additional 1 inch of forward flexion. You can get more if we go with a larger lace extender, or some people don't need as much, so they'd go with a smaller lace extender. The work that we did in the lab took this concept to the ice and put it through, for lack of a better term, a series of different clinical trials to say, does it make a difference? Does it make a difference in the performance of the athletes? Can they skate faster? Can they stop quicker? Can they accelerate faster? Can they harness that power that they have within the body better with this device? And the athletes that we worked with, the youngest was 6, 7, 8, your minor league kids, your developmental crew, they're trying to acquire skills, all the way through to the pros and the retired pros like Troy himself. Across the board, the research data spoke very, very strongly to supporting the ability to flex to be able to be a better skater. When you take a step back from that statement and you want to say, well, isn't that obvious? You have to bend at your ankles and knees to be able to push or to be able to perform. But it's interesting how the boot that was developed for the purpose of performance was missing a key component. And so we filled the gap in the development of the product.
So this is a great example of how research being done at Brock can be placed in the real world and make a difference. Here's an example of the work you are doing, changing not the world, but a small part of it.
Well, the most important part, the hockey world, the part I love.
Exactly.
It's your world, that's for sure.
It is my world, and it's also Kelly's world. Figure skating, skating in general, it's her passion, and for me it's the same thing. Basically, I'm a sport nut in all cases, but winter sports, and in particular hockey, are my passion. So when I was done playing hockey, I tried to figure out what I want to do in my life, and basically knew that I loved to teach, I loved to learn, and I loved the sport of hockey, and I started in this direction with trying to figure out the skates. Tried many other little jobs in between, but after 8 years of doing other things, I always kept coming back to the skates. And I said, well, you know what? I've always been told that if you do what you love as a job, you don't really feel like you're working. And so I stopped all the other jobs and focused on this. And it is true. Like, I don't think at any point you can put me in an arena or in the lab testing or trying to figure out or solve problems that have to do with the sport I love. And to me, it doesn't feel like work. And so it's a lot of fun. And it's nice to work with Kelly, who's also so passionate about it.
Now, Kelly, I wanted to talk before we wrap up here about when I toured the kinesiology department in December with my nephew Rory, who's from Kenora, and he did incidentally apply to go to Brock, just so you know. We were amazed by the skating treadmill that takes up a huge space in your lab.
Don't tell Brock that. With space being a premium. No, I'm actually, we retrofit a racquetball court at Brock University due to the lack of space that we have. We're a growing university, and of course, you're pushing the boundaries of new buildings and walls. So we found a racquetball court that worked out absolutely perfect. The skating treadmill is a very large device, very similar to a running treadmill. However, triple the size and weighs about 5,000 pounds. It is artificial ice, so it's a simulated environment. But we've used it originally for the purpose of investigating skating mechanics. When someone says, is that skater efficient? You have to be able to say why and what do they do differently to become efficient. So a lot of the original work was to analyze the skating stride and what defines an efficient skating stride. That work extended to become a huge training device that for the purpose of research, if we know what an efficient skating stride is, can we use it to train athletes to become more efficient? Coaches loved it because honestly, a lot of your volunteer coaches that work with your minor hockey leagues know the sport well. They know systems, they know strategies, they know rules. But they're not biomechanists. And can they teach skating? So they would send us their kids, they send us their players, they come to the lab. Our niche is skating mechanics. We teach them how to skate. I then turn them over to the coach and say, the rest is your job. And so it's a really nice marriage with the community of hockey to be able to say we've contributed. We've been able to tick off that one check mark or that one box that says this kid can skate and it's the foundation of the game.
Troy, have you been on the skating treadmill yourself?
I've done it a few times, and for a guy who weighs 250 pounds, it's a lot of work. there's not much glide. so it was hard. And at the point, I was still doing a lot of work on my skates and moving blades and doing things. And now that I think I've got them tuned in pretty good, I wouldn't mind trying it again just to see it. But for the concept of learning and seeing, it's great because the person is right there and you're not trying to follow someone flying by you. And so you can really see the mechanics of it. And then also, I like it in the concept that when you train in hockey on normal ice, you're always more focused on how much harder can you push. And there's also a second factor in skating is how quickly can you bring your leg back up to recovery position to re-push again. And because there's no glide on that treadmill, I think it's very good for increasing the natural tendency to bring your leg up quicker to recovery point back under your body. It forces you to because there is no glide. I think that it has a training benefit along with a teaching benefit as well. But I'm retired, so I don't have to work that hard. It's more for kids and people who are trying to get to a level. I'm happy with my retired level.
All of the work that we do in mechanics are easy to train. However, there's something that if you train mechanics right the first time and you never have to change an old technique, it's so much more efficient. I always draw the parallel or comparison that as we get older, it's hard to develop strength and develop speed and develop cardiovascular endurance, but you can always become more efficient through good mechanics. So in an ideal world, we'll train our young athletes, our learners, right the first time. They'll never have to change their mechanics. mechanics. They'll never have to revise or relearn something. And it'll take them to a level that'll last them a lifetime. As their bodies develop and they get stronger and bigger, they can harness those mechanics through that physicality. The neat thing, and I have to admit, when I first was asked to skate on a treadmill myself as a competitive figure skater, honestly, I said, why? Let me just go to the ice and train. That's where I have to compete. That's where it makes a difference. I've rethought that many times, obviously. I now own 4 treadmills. But I've rethought that because it's a very strong stimulus for change. Athletes will say to me, but we never skate uphill on the ice. Why are you making us train uphill? Well, if you look at what sprinters do, all skating mechanics is stolen from the world of sprinting. We share and share alike in sport. And sprinters train uphill to increase the speed of recoil. A skating stride is made up of 2 phases. You push and you recoil to push again. If you're not pushing, you're slowing down. So if it takes longer for you to recoil that leg, especially when we're talking the likes of Troy at 225 pounds and 6'5", that leg is a tree stump and it's got to come back quickly. If it doesn't, you decelerate. And the idea is to keep accelerating, not decelerate or not slow down within the game. So the mechanics of a treadmill are a strong stimulus of change and allow us to elicit the mechanical response in the athlete. Some of the first research that we did on the treadmill, I was allowed to say nothing. I just had to look at what the combinations of computations of different speeds and different elevations, what they would elicit mechanically, and hung on to that and developed the system of training through the equipment. Kids love it when they become efficient and they don't have to push any harder to get going down the ice faster.
Okay, here's the million-dollar question to wrap up. Would your skating treadmill help someone like myself?
Certainly.
I'll take that under advisement. I'm not quite sure yet what I'll do with that.
Tell you, for one, get Kelly to fit skates to you properly first. If they don't fit you, you're going to be struggling against a lot of biomechanics there. So the proper fit is number one, and then proper technique and coaching is number two, and three is just the willpower, right? If you want to do something, you can do anything in your life. You just got to have the willpower.
Okay. Well, on that note, I don't know if I have the willpower or not, but we'll see. Kelly and Troy, thank you both very much. This is fascinating, and it's great to see research being put out there into the marketplace and being a success. And I wish you both the best of luck with all the work you do together and separately.
Thank you.
And that was Kelly Lockwood, Associate Professor of Kinesiology in the Department of Health Sciences at Brock, along with Troy Crowder, retired NHL player and CEO of a company that worked closely with Kelly to develop a new device to increase the flexibility of boots of hockey players. Kelly is currently on sabbatical and apparently now has her voice back after cheering on both Canadian women's and men's hockey teams to hockey gold last week at the Olympics. Back in December, we talked to Brock Associate Professor in the Department of Classics, Fanny Delansky, about the customs and origins surrounding Saturnalia, which occurred just prior to Christmas. Recently, Fanny was co-awarded the 2014 Barbara McManus Prize for Best Published Article on Gender or Women's Studies in Antiquity. Her award-winning paper is entitled Playing with Gender, Girls, Dolls, and Adult Ideals in the Roman World. I invited Fanny back into the studio recently to talk about the award, her paper, and other aspects of her research on Roman social and cultural history. I asked Fanny about the award and what the significance of winning it means.
Well, I think for me, what's most gratifying is that this is an award that is determined by peers and it's blind refereed. So you submit your material or someone submits your material for you and the people reading at the committee has no idea who is the author. And so it really is a peer-determined award, which for me is really gratifying.
Now, you were co-awarded the prize. So do we know, presumably you know, who you're sharing the award with?
I do. I think this is probably the first year since this prize was established, the award has been split between 2 different scholars, and I'm sharing the award with someone who is quite well established, a scholar at Princeton University, Brooke Holmes, who works on philosophy and Greek literature and tragedy. So for me to be sharing the award with somebody who is very accomplished and well-respected is a bit of an accolade for me as well.
And I'm sure in the interview that she did, she said the same thing about you.
I hope so.
When you are co-awarded a prize, are you able to have any contact with that person?
We haven't actually had any contact. I think we might have had had I been able to attend the awards ceremony. And unfortunately, the ceremony occurred at the beginning of January at a conference during the polar vortex deep freeze. And so I was quite literally stuck on the tarmac in Chicago waiting to deplane for several hours, having fortunately been able to get out of Buffalo after a very long and snowy delay. So I would have had an opportunity, I think, to meet the co-awardee at the time, but it didn't work out.
So let's talk about your paper. Even in Roman times, girls played with dolls. I don't think that's much of a surprise, but how similar to today's dolls were the dolls that they played with back then?
I think there are some points of overlap in terms of appearance. Certainly in terms of material, no, the dolls from antiquity, aside from cloth dolls and rag dolls, the dolls were mostly made from bone and ivory and wood, which is something that today, clearly, the vast majority of dolls are made from plastic. So that's an area where things divide simply because of the advance of time. But in terms of what the dolls looked like and girls being able to actually dress them and make them move, most of the dolls that I study were jointed, so the arms moved and the legs moved, and so girls could pose them and make them move and do their hair, that sort of thing. So there are a fair number of similarities.
So you were able to actually view the dolls then?
I've seen a number of them in museums at Rome. I haven't requested permission to study them individually, but I have seen a few that are on display.
For us, when we think of dolls, we're obviously thinking of Barbie. Was this sort of like an early Roman version of Barbie, if you will, or entirely different?
I think it depends on the particular dolls. Barbie I see as a fashion doll, and the dolls that I've studied from antiquity were in many ways fashion dolls. I mean, these are dolls with beautiful hair, sometimes gold jewelry. They look like adult women. And so I think there are a lot of parallels there in terms of both appearance and how girls might have played with them. Of course, one of the things that I argue in my research is that just as girls today may dress up Barbie and pose her and have her sort of, you know, enjoy sedate, fashionable activities, the girls also play with Barbies in all sorts of ways that Mattel, as the manufacturer or parents, might not have anticipated. And I think that girls in antiquity probably did the same thing. It's simply a feature of childhood that there's play that's fueled by imagination, and kids do all sorts of things that we as adults don't necessarily anticipate or entirely understand.
It's inherent with having a doll there. You role play. Today, Barbie's depicted as just about everything from a career woman to something of an adventurer and almost always a free spirit. But what about the dolls in ancient Roman times? Were they filling roles back then? And if so, what were the roles?
Most of the dolls were modeled after upper class adult women. And so some of them resemble empresses or other figures from the imperial government. And so I think rather than having this range of possibilities built into the doll in the way that Barbie sometimes appears as a president or as an adventurer, what have you, in antiquity, these dolls were meant to look like a particular figure. They were meant to look like an upper class married Roman woman. So very well put together in terms of hair and clothing, some resembling empresses. What kids chose to do with them beyond that, though, of course, is a matter of debate.
I gather the dolls would be directing the girls to contemplate growing up to be a wife or a mother, as opposed to a career woman.
Certainly as opposed to a career woman, and that's because with the exception of, I mean, certainly women in the lower classes, slave women, were involved in all sorts of occupations, but upper class women were meant to be essentially stay-at-home housewives. That said, one of the things that I've argued is that the dolls that resemble empresses, I think, gave girls the opportunity to at least toy with the idea of themselves being essentially career women in the sense of being, you know, the equivalent of a president's wife. And some of these empresses had very public roles, involved in charities to benefit children, involved in parades and ceremonies to promote their husbands. So not a career woman in the sense that we would think of it in the 21st century, but a different set of occupations, certainly, from being a housewife. And that's not at all to diminish the sorts of responsibilities that Roman upper class women had within the household, but it's not a career beyond that domain.
You could be a society woman who is doing great work within the community. That comes with the territory of having a certain amount of power and prestige, courtesy of the situation that you're in.
Right, so absolutely.
The dolls would reflect that.
Yes.
Okay. Would there be dolls for different classes? For example, if you were a middle class, for want of a better expression, dolls that reflected their way of life and those who are depicting, as you suggest, the well-to-do, the empresses, and those with power and prestige?
It's an excellent question. I wish that we had both literary and archaeological evidence that could answer that more conclusively. I think that the dolls that we have that are made from more common, less costly materials, so dolls carved from bone or wood, let's say, as opposed to ivory, certainly dolls made from cloth or rags, those are the sorts of dolls that I think we can more readily imagine being possibly owned by girls of the lower echelons once in society, at least played with by those girls. But I think that toys were largely luxury items, and certainly these dolls, even some of the cloth dolls, clearly there's a fair bit of effort that has gone into manufacturing these. And so I'm not certain that girls of the lower orders would have necessarily been able to own some of these playthings.
I guess being able to look at the dolls, you'd be able to see the handiwork that would go into them. And when you say manufacture, today we think manufacture, we're thinking like Henry Ford manufacturing cars on an assembly line. It would have been people working at a table assembling the dolls back then, so it would be an entirely different thing. A lot of handiwork that goes into it. Probably the detail, I would imagine, would be quite intricate as well.
There is a little bit of evidence, though, for I guess what we might think of as small-scale manufacturing, in that there are a couple of workshops that have been discovered in Rome, one on the Palatine Hill that was a bone carving workshop. And so what we have there, it's very interesting, we have doll bodies in different stages of completion, and some where clearly the workman made an error and the torso broke, or for whatever reason it was abandoned and another was taken up instead. So we do have a bit of evidence for, as I said, sort of small-scale workshop-based manufacture, but certainly nothing like the mass production of Barbie or other dolls today.
I'm interested in the notion women's adornment would prove controversial for Roman men. Why?
That's an excellent question. Roman men tended to associate adornment with two very different spheres. On the one hand, in a positive way, adornment is associated with certain religious ceremonies, with worship of certain goddesses, and there are rites involved in preparing the goddess's statue, adorning it, fixing the hair, that sort of thing. On the other hand, and more often, adornment is associated with vice, with women being frivolous, wasting money, wasting time, being extravagant, and the end of the spectrum is prostitution. So women's adornment is controversial because it lies between those two ends of sort of reverence and prostitution, and it's an easy sort of scale for men to see women sliding towards the prostitution end of things.
I am seeing an interesting social commentary here, because Roman men, certainly those in positions of power, would not have been without adornment.
Of course.
Why would it be okay for them? Are they the only ones who are allowed to wear adornment, show it off, show their power? What's going on here?
Well, certainly, I mean, though men were very anxious at times about women's adornment, it's a bit of a catch-22, because certainly elite women, upper-class women, even lower down in the social orders, women were also expected to be put together. I mean, so there's this very conflicting set of messages. On the one hand, your hair should be done, and you should dress nicely, and you should wear appropriate jewelry, and maybe you should wear a little bit of makeup. You don't want to go too far in the other direction and sort of overdo it. So I think it must have presented women, and particularly girls, with almost a set of expectations that they didn't quite know how to meet. I mean, how much time is too much time spent having a slave fix your hair? Or is it endless? When does wearing cosmetics slide into an area that's problematic? So it's a difficult area.
Well, yeah, because any woman who's the wife of a well-to-do, well-off, and powerful man in Roman society would be expected to be well turned out, if you will. I would have thought she would be criticized if she weren't. It would be incumbent upon her to show off her husband in the best light, including looking good in her own way.
Right. And of course, you know, the sort of the rhetoric that surrounds women's adornment and the negative criticism, it's hard to know how much of that actually can be mapped onto everyday life. I think you're certainly correct that there was an expectation that when women would go out, that they would be put together and that they would be not just presentable, but would bring praise to a husband having an attractive wife who's put together, having an attractive daughter. So this sort of some of the negative criticism, it's hard to know whether the majority of men actually felt this way, or is this a moralizing streak in the rhetoric that didn't necessarily play out on a regular basis?
Yeah, this looks to me like it's a real mixed message.
Yes.
The men want it both ways.
Right.
Hmm.
And certainly some of the moralizing comes from early Christian authors, and so I think there we're dealing with a slightly different set of concerns. It's a bit of backlash against paganism surviving and wanting Christian women to keep themselves separate from Roman ideas about adornment and appearance.
So the girls would essentially be using the dolls as a way of learning how to present themselves in Roman society, in terms of how to dress, present yourself, move, that sort of thing?
I mean, I think that's one of the ways in which the dolls could have been used and probably were used, but I think we need to be open to the possibility that while girls may have spent time posing a doll or dressing her, that they also may have spent time with the doll doing all sorts of other things.
Just like today.
Yes.
We talked about actually looking at the dolls, going and viewing yourself the dolls. It must have been a big job. Any research project is going to be a time-intensive and big job. But how much was involved for you in researching your paper. It must have been just monumental.
Well, this is actually a project that has its origins in my graduate work. I wrote a seminar paper for an archaeology seminar on the material evidence for children's toys, and dolls was just one part of it. So this has been a project that I've been thinking about for now many years. But you're right, the research was intensive in different ways. I've spent some time looking at some of the dolls in museums in Rome, a lot of library work, particularly in American universities, looking at the different aspects, the dolls themselves, which tend to be published in less mainstream publications. And so tracking these down is sometimes difficult. Most of the literature on the dolls is not published in English. And so working through French and Spanish and Italian and German articles is time consuming. And then, you know, building the argument around the different areas, the use of imperial models, the adornment, trying to get a handle on the ancient evidence and modern scholarly responses to it as well. It was an involved project, but one that I really enjoyed.
Now, you're going to be presenting another paper in Norway in May of this year. So what will that paper be on?
This is for a conference on Roman childhood that I've been invited to speak at, specifically asked to look at the material evidence, so the archaeological evidence for children's play. And one of the particular goals of the conference is to try to, not just the archaeological evidence, but evidence in general, to try to tease out evidence for children's agency. I'll be looking at the dolls again, but also other archaeological evidence in terms of actual artifacts, so children's toys, but there are a lot of representations on funerary sarcophagi, day-to-day objects like plates and bowls that depict children at play, and match that with the literary evidence and see if we can get a sense of when children were taking control of their own playtime and using toys to fashion identity and express things. I think that aspect will be challenging. Understanding how material evidence can contribute and build up a picture of children's play, that's the easy part. Whether inside of that evidence there really is anything about agency, I'm less convinced.
Now, just to jump the gun a little bit, what have you discovered about the play patterns of the children in ancient Rome that would be different from today?
Certainly in representations, and one of the aspects of my work for this Norway conference is looking at the difference between representations and realities. And so in representations of children's play, there seems to be a clear divide between boys and girls. Boys play is even sometimes in the same image, and there'll be a group of boys and a group of girls playing. They play separately. The boys are often involved in physical sort of rough and tumble play. They pull, they push. The girls are often presented very sedate. They're orderly. So I think that there's this sense that at least in adult eyes, play is something that starts to instill appropriate gender roles, status roles as well. One of the other aspects of my research, aside from looking at gender, is also to try to tease out from the evidence what we know about lower class and slave children playing. Did they have opportunities to play? If so, what are they depicted playing with? What sort of literary evidence do we have for that as well? I mean, many lower class children and certainly slaves were laborers. I mean, they worked. That was their life. Was their time carved into their day for play?
I suspect it might not have been. They would have just had an opportunity. They would grab an opportunity if it presented itself.
Right.
In between chores. That would have been their lot of life. And they would have been used to that, not thrilled about it, but used to it.
Right. And I mean, unfortunately, the vast majority of literature that we have from the ancient world is authored by elite men who are interested in, first and foremost, other elite men. Even elite children or freeborn children are really not even a secondary concern. And so to find evidence for slaves at play is really challenging. The archaeological and art historical evidence is certainly more promising.
Yeah, because if the men are doing the writing who are well off, what do they care about the children who are slaves?
Right.
Now, I wanted to find out about how you became interested in Roman social history to begin with. I find it particularly fascinating, but you've gone beyond that. You've made it your livelihood. This is why you are here at Brock University. So how did it all begin for you?
Well, I think there are sort of two formative moments. One is that as a child, I was always interested in languages, and my parents had been born in Montreal and had done all of their schooling in Quebec, where studying Latin was part of the high school curriculum. So we had old Latin textbooks sort of kicking around in the basement, and I was always curious from my own studies in school of French and other languages. So it was partly on a linguistic basis, but when I was about 9 or 10, the National Geographic magazine, which my grandmother had kindly paid to have sent to us each month, put out two issues about the recent excavations in Pompeii and Herculaneum. And I can still picture the cover arriving with the skeleton of a woman with her gold bangles and earrings and other jewels. And, you know, opening the pages of this and reading about how daily life had been preserved because of this catastrophic event and just being sort of instantly smitten. And it went from there. I'm an unusual classicist in that I've been interested in studying antiquity and particularly Roman material since childhood. Most people discover this and they take a university course and say, hey, this is interesting. But for me, this is since early childhood.
It's your livelihood.
It is.
It's not just a university course.
Right.
Thank you very much for coming in today, Fanny. And congratulations on the award and best of luck in the future. You're on sabbatical now. How long are you on sabbatical for?
Till June 30th.
Okay, so after you get back from Norway, then you head back.
That's right.
Thank you and welcome back ahead of when you actually do get back.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure having an opportunity to talk a little more about my research.
And there we heard from Fanny Dolansky, associate professor in the Department of Classics, who recently was co-awarded the 2014 Barbara McManus Prize for Best Published Article on Gender or Women's Studies in Antiquity. Her paper is entitled Playing with Gender, Girls, Dolls, and Adult Ideals in the Roman World. Just before we go, on Tuesday of this week, I attended the celebration of Brock University research held in the Guernsey Market, and congratulations to all the award winners there this week. Many of those research projects on display this week will hopefully be covered on future editions of Inquisitive Minds. While there, I also acted as a judge for the preliminary round of the 3-minute thesis competition held at Pond Inlet. In all, 10 students wowed us with their compressed yet interesting thesis descriptions, and although all 10 were worthy, only 5 will go on to the Brock finals to be held April the 7th. We'll keep you posted on the results after the finals, of course, but for now, congratulations to all for a job well done. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. ¶¶